Today I'd like to share some thoughts that come from Rosemary Ruther, who is a distinguished theologian and scholar. The irony of Rosemary Ruther is that in 2016 she suffered a significant stroke. And her thought processes are fine, she has physical mobility, but ironically, she cannot speak. And it must be so frustrating for her and for those who so have enjoyed her presentations. She's still doing some writing and some research, but of course is profoundly limited. She is remembered and thought about mostly because of her work relevant to the relationship between feminism and the Christian faith, parenthesis, the Catholic Church. Rosemary Ruther was born in 1936 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Her mother, Rebecca, was a significant individual in that her father, Robert, died when she was only 12 years of age, and her mother raised her and a brother and a sister in a rather significant fashion. She surrounded her children with people who had open minds, but always the sense of the open mind was related to something that was very grounded. It wasn't a kind of cavalier openness. It was an openness that was generated out of knowing, thinking, reasoning. And Rosemary Ruther, of course, grew in that experience. She benefited from studying under Jesuits. And that can never hurt you. She also benefited by studying under some Carmelites. Carmelite tradition divides their year in two pieces. The first year is spent in half a year is spent in meditation. The second half is spent in some sort of service. So they link together a very definite social arm that is always related to a meditative kind of theological basis. Early on, Rosemary Ruther was made aware of two things. Catholicism is a deep, rich, and significant tradition. It should be taken seriously, and it should be investigated. However, when you take it seriously and investigate, sometimes you have to come up with some questions. And for Rosemary Ruther, the ultimate question that began to emerge for her was, what is it with this concept of a priesthood that is so male-dominated? And not only was it so male-dominated, but it also practiced a kind of control that was predicated upon the fact that men are somehow more knowledgeable than women. And so from the very beginnings of her youth, she wondered about that. She went off to college. And in that context, there were two men that had a very important impact upon her. The first one was her Uncle David, who happened to be a practicing Jew. And he made her aware of how difficult it was to be a Jew in a Gentile society. She learned from him the personal pain of those who lose, of those who are controlled, those who are made to feel less than. It was a very strong lesson that Uncle David taught her, not by words, but as she wrote in her book, My Quest for Hope and Salvation, I learned about Uncle David's tears. The second person that really had a powerful impact was a guy by the name of Robert Palmer. He taught at Scripps College in California. He had a couple of interesting ideas. Here was the first one. Yes, God is a fundamental kind of thought. There is something that is fundamental about God. And we call that absolute. We call it transcendent. We call it unknown. However, Palmer also taught her that while this God is very fundamental and transcendent, this God is expressed in a variety of unfolding ways. So that she learned from her professor a deep and profound awareness of God. It was strong, it was determined, it was anchored. However, she also learned from him that this God is expressed in a wide and various modality. She learned something else. She began to learn about racism. She began to learn about sexism. She began to learn about militarism and imperialism. And the thing that really quickened her process was that, ironically, she encountered all of those thought patterns in a place that apparently was against them all: the church. The church said, in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male or female. But try to get ordained if you're a woman. The church said, peace for all. Only the history beginning way back when, up through the Crusades and even into modern eras, the church has often been involved in violence of its own making. Certainly the church was all about racism. It was also about imperialism, trying to make people across the world think and be what we wanted them to think and be. And so she had this interesting sense of contradiction between what it was that the church, and when she uses that term, the church, it's a generic term, it certainly is implicit of her Catholicity, but it is also implicit of a Catholicity that is spelt with a small c. She began to see the difficulty there. And she began to think about how important it was to address that. And as a graduate student, she began to think about the need to change how it was that the church related to those particular areas. And I find it interesting the modality with which she began the enterprise. Number one, she talks about critical dialogue. And by critical, she does not mean negative. She means open, thoughtful. Dialogue speaks for itself. Two, she talks about the need for prayer. And as I read that again, I was mindful of my professor, Dr. Carl Michelson, who was without a doubt one of the most relevant, socially minded theologians you're ever going to encounter. I think I mentioned to you several weeks ago that the New York Times once described him as a profound man of faith who resembled a middleweight prize fighter. Isn't it interesting that Mike taught us to raise questions? He taught us to wonder about the linguistic realities of the Bible. And also he opened every class session with these words: might we pray? Three, she also felt that reflection was important. Now, when she talks about reflection, she's not talking about wondering, you know, why is there air? She's talking about a dynamic, aggressive kind of energy that when you finish doing it, you are fatigued. Reflection was energizing. Oh, and she also talked about compassion. That is to say, having a sense of sensitivity to the world around you. All of that gave birth to some initial writings that she made concerning the church as its own enemy. And she talked about in that book the fact that the church embraced positions that really did call into question its credibility. And she said in light of that, there needed to be a couple of things undertaken. Number one, there needed to be a sense of critique. There needed to be a sense by which the church was subject to interrogation. Why? Number two, she also felt the following with critique, but somewhat in tandem with it, it was necessary to affirm what was good in the tradition. It's the old adage of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Number three, She also believed that once the critique and the affirmation had occurred as expressions of energy, it was important to move toward a synthesis, a forging of something new and something that was balanced. And in order to do all of that, she began to do some thinking that I think is germane not only to the questions of sexism in the church, but I think the very essence of the church itself. She begins, for example, with a discussion of who or what God is. She rejects the notion that somehow God is some sort of a transcendent personality who wanders around in the clouds. She even rejects the idea that we should be thinking about God as a personality or a person. And she embraces Paul Tillich's understanding that God is really a transcendent matrix. And what that means is this: it is a place where all of the diversities that are expressed in the world interface. A matrix is a place, a kind of a confluence, where the various expressions of life and death, faith and belief, prayer and sacrament, interact with each other and produce that synthesis. She also talks about the fact that this God, this matrix, is a place that embraces all dualities. The wonder of God, she writes, is that no matter your name, your place, or your faith, God, the matrix, welcomes you. She believed that God expressed ultimately what we mean when we talk about the wholeness of life, in that the God that she believed in was a God who understood something about spirituality, but also, she writes, the reality of getting through a day. This is a God who understands the relationship between the natural world, the environment, and the world of ideas and spirituality. This is a God who understands and embraces all of the wonderful diversity that is inherent in the world. And she says that that God has about its identity a kind of fluidity. God is not static. God is not the same day after day. But rather, God is all about a dynamic energy that allows for us to live. She also rejects some of the patriarchal concepts that have grown up about God. Her notion is that, for example, the Old Testament is filled with rules and guidance and statements that suggest quite clearly that God is a man, and that somehow women are a second level of creation. She embraces the thought of a little story I once heard about an African-American woman who had to have open-heart surgery. And so she went to the hospital, and they began the procedure. And about halfway through the procedure, her heart stopped. And so immediately they introduced the paddles, and they kept watching the clock. 1 minute, two minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. And suddenly her heart clicked back into rhythm. The surgery was completed successfully, and just before discharge, the young surgeon who had saved her life came in to say goodbye. And he said, "You know, Mary, while you were on the table, medically, you died." "Oh," she said, "I know that, doctor." "Well," he said, "I have a question for you. While you were dead, did you by chance see God?" "Oh, yeah," she said, "I saw God." "Well," said the young man, "what did he look like?" And the old woman said, "She was black." So we get where Ruther's going here. We need to stop defining God and let God define us. Number two, she has a very, very clear understanding of Christology, Jesus, the Christ. Make no mistake about it, Rosemary Ruther is a Christian. She has a deep and abiding faith in the Lordship of Jesus Christ. However, as she looks at this Christ, there are a couple of things that she says that I think are so important. Here's the first one. For her, Jesus is neither ahistorical or apolitical. And what that means is this. Jesus was a player. Jesus fully participated in the realities of the history in which he found himself. He wasn't some sort of a unique being who sort of stood on the edges of life looking in. He participated in the realities of his time. And he did that politically. And she suggests that indeed the Bible, the New Testament, is pretty clear about that. And in the great tradition of so many theologians, she reminds us that it may be that Jesus was crucified to save the world. But it's also clear that Jesus was crucified because he had offended the Sanhedrin, because he was a threat to Rome, because he was an outspoken liberator of lepers and women and Samaritans. Jesus, she says, was historical, and he was political. Number two, she writes about the fact that in her mind, Jesus is inclusive and therefore should never be used to support or cement exclusivity. She particularly makes reference to the fact that unfortunately Christians have historically used their faith in Jesus to make disparaging comments about those who do not believe in Jesus as Lord and Savior. And of course she's having specific reference to her own Catholic Church, who for centuries held on to the ridiculous notion that the Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus. And it wasn't until John Paul II, standing at the wall in Jerusalem, said, "I apologize for what my church has said about Judaism." For Rosemary Ruther, Jesus was always inclusive and should never be used to support such terms as non-believer. Three, she obviously makes the place that Jesus was clearly antithetical to the misogyny of his time. And that's pretty evident. Do you remember the woman who poured oil on his feet and cleaned them with her hair, and how the guys said, "What a dumb business decision that was." And Jesus said to them, "Hey, shut up. She has done a beautiful thing." And isn't it interesting that Jesus affirmed women consistently? Women like Mary Magdalene, Mary and Martha. The involvement he had with women. And of course, she points up something that most people have overlooked. It wasn't the guys that went to the early tomb. They were back in the hotel with the door locked, waiting for room service. It was the women who came. So for her, the fact that Jesus chose 12 disciples, male disciples, is just accidental. And in fact, due to people like Elaine Pagel at Princeton, we're now beginning to think that in fact, Mary Magdalene was the disciple upon whom Jesus really depended. And lastly, she says that the meaning of Jesus in the context of Christianity must never be taken lightly. Because Jesus is the expression of a new being. And that new being is somebody who has a newness as to what humanity means and what community means. And she defines that pretty clearly. Jesus, for example, in defining the new humanity, said, "The first shall be last and the last shall be first." He also said, "You must be as a teacher and a student, more so a student than a teacher." Jesus taught us by precept and example that the new humanity is about vulnerability, service, dreaming dreams. And certainly the new community that Jesus talked about, the kingdom. She makes the point, the kingdom came in Jesus. We just didn't recognize it. Therefore, Christians must always take Jesus seriously because Jesus defines our new humanity and our new community. I'm currently wrapping up 3 weeks of teaching in a program at the college, which we call Opportunity. It's a program that is designed for young men and women who come from first-generation college families. This is the first time a member of those families have come to college. Number two, they're kids who are hanging on. They're on the ropes academically. There are also kids who have come they've come through some hard places because most of them are African American. And Friday I shared with Barbara, I had a wonderful experience. The director of the program intercepted me as I'm on my way to the classroom. She said, "Jack, I have a favor." She said, "The mother of Michael," I'll leave his last name go, "Michael is here and she'd like to come to class. Is that okay with you?" Of course. So when I went into the classroom, there was Michael's mom sitting with him. And at the break, she came up to me and was very gracious. And she said, "I just want you to know that you have my permission to regularly kick his because he is lazy and needs to be motivated." At the end of the class, four African-American students lingered. And we talked about things like the talk. Do you know what the talk is? That's the conversation that black parents have with their children about if a cop stops you, pay attention, do what he says. Don't get out there and be a smiley. Don't try to take on the world. You might die. So we talked about the talk. We talked about where some of these young men have been. But you know the thing that really got inside of my heart? One of the young men, Michael. Oh, the other interesting about Michael is this. She was telling me about whenever Michael was born, she and her husband had this discussion about his name. What were you to call him? And her husband, who is a bricklayer, said, "Look, we're not going down the road of giving him one of those African names. You know what I'm saying? You know, Maja, Haja, Wuja, whatever. We're going to call him Michael." And his reasoning was this. He said, it's going to be hard enough for him that he's black. He doesn't need to have a name that nobody else can pronounce. And so Michael, as he was in this little discussion, said something to me. He said, "You know, Doc," he said, "in this room is one of the few places where I feel accepted." Notice he did not say tolerated. Toleration doesn't count. Accepted. That's Jesus. That's the kingdom, according to Rosemary Ruther. But when she talks about sin, and what she says about sin, I think is pretty perceptive. For her, sin is not that list that grows out of our social mores of a given era. For her, sin is a distortion of a relationship. And therefore, sin and that level of distortion can clearly exist between two individuals. It can also exist between an individual and a culture. It can also exist between an individual and God. It doesn't matter who's in the relationship. Sin occurs whenever the potentiality of that relationship and the real meaning of it are distorted. And she says that sin has to be understood in two ways. First, personal. Her notion is that all sin begins in a person. Begins with a word, a thought, an attitude. And it's ours. We live by it. The great ethicist James Gustafson was once talking about our morality. And he said, morality is not what we do and are whenever the world's watching. Morality is what we do by ourselves in the dark. And that is her perception of where sin begins, in that dark, private place where we have those thoughts, where we use terms such as those people, or queer, or dumb woman. And they become our credo. And when they become our credo, she writes, sin becomes institutionalized. And I think we can all understand what she's saying there. It's institutionalized in and through the church. My denomination in 1939 met in Kansas City. We at that point had three expressions of Methodism. Methodist Episcopal Church, Methodist Episcopal Church South, and Methodist Protestant Church. The reason we had a church in the South was we had split in 1840 over the question of slavery. They said, we want slaves, we're going to keep them. In 1939, we came together, ready for this, in the name of Jesus Christ, to celebrate our unity. And we brought together those three structures. And we called it the Methodist Church. And then we began to deal with how that Methodist Church was going to be structured. And we thought the best way to do that was geographically. And so we broke the United States into six jurisdictions. Northeast, Southeast, And then there was a seventh. It was the central jurisdiction. It was not geographical. It was racial. So that if you were a Methodist living in New York City and white, you belonged to the northeastern jurisdiction. If you were a white Methodist living in Los Angeles, you belonged to the southwestern jurisdiction. And if you were an African-American Methodist living in Los Angeles or in New York, it didn't matter. You belonged to the central jurisdiction. They had their own bishops, their own structures. And it wasn't until 1960 that we finally said, that needs to change. Rosemary Ruther's right. We institutionalize our personal sins. And then we give them very acceptable titles. But they nevertheless persevere. She writes that Christianity, the wonder of Jesus, is committed to changing not only our hearts, but our institutions? And she says that is a question that requires all of us to look deep into our values, into our true self, and into the institutions that we embrace. And then she talks about salvation, and she talks about hope. I love what she says. She says, salvation is not so much being rescued from eternal punishment. Salvation is much more about discovering alternatives that make life good. She believes that salvation is not about futuristic judgment. Salvation is about now. It's about here. And it is about change. For her, salvation is something that brings about a new day, a new way, a new experience. We do not have to die physically in order to experience the wonder of salvation. It is here. It is now. And it is ours. I experience salvation regularly. And one of the places where I experience it is on Tuesday afternoons in the Metten Room, which is a private dining room, where I sit down with maybe 25 to 30 kids. We grab something out of the cafeteria and bring it over, and we sit down and have some dinner together, and we laugh and we talk. Let me tell you about that group. Over there, there's a young African-American kid. One night we were talking about holidays and Christmas and how difficult that all can be. And this is what she said. If you white guys think Christmas is tough for you, you ought to come to my house on Christmas. She said, I have 5 brothers and 3 sisters. And they all have different dads. And she was free to say that. Over there, that's Russell. Russell's gay. He's a believing Catholic kid. And he's lived for 2.5 years on that campus, hiding who he is. And now we know, he knows. Russell is a great guy. Sometimes he does some outlandish things. For example, I was one afternoon walking down the hall with one of our more conservative monks. And suddenly, out of nowhere, hey, Doc! Oh, and over here, that's Mitch. Mitch graduated. He's now an accountant. Deep, conservative, Catholic background. And one afternoon, he stopped by my office, and he said to me, I just want to tell you something, Doc. He said, I'm free to accept black people and gay people. And I don't have to carry around all that hate anymore. That's salvation. And for an old white guy, what a wonderful experience. Because salvation is always, according to Rosemary Ruther anyway, it is always a shared experience. What are some of the sources that Rosemary Ruther uses to have some of these kinds of thoughts? The first is the Hebrew Bible, that Old Testament. Because as I think I suggested to you at our very first session, in that book, yeah, there's a lot of very, very misogynistic ideas. No question about that. But boy, every now and then you see some of those very strong women who said, like hell. And they stood up. And they did the right thing. She also uses the New Testament, because contrary to the attempts of St. Paul to make the church a theology by men for men, there is evidence of the feminine component of that first century church. And Rosemary Ruther says that when you look at those scriptures, ironically, what you discover is that the true essence of Jesus and the body of Christ, the church, the true essence of that makes it impossible for the church to hold the positions it does relevant to women. The point being, she thinks of herself as a rather conservative Catholic. Are you ready for that? But what she means by that is, she has discovered at the very core of her faith the kinds of things that cause her to question the institutionalization of sin. Number two, she also is interested in using what she calls the delegitimatized texts. These are the ones that didn't make it into the canon. But if you think about it long enough, who was it that organized the canon? It was the good old boys club. They brought together some of the dudes with the big hats, and they said, "Here's going to be our Bible." And it's not brain surgery that they left out the Gospel of Mary. It's not accidental they left out some of the things we call agnostic. Why? Because those texts challenged what they were trying to do. So Rosemary Ruther's concept is, we ought to be reading some of that stuff and trying to figure out what it means. Three, she also believes that the tradition of the church is worth investigating. Because she believes that the tradition of the church, and by that she means certainly Catholicism, and of course Protestantism, and of course Orthodoxy. She believes that in all three of those branches of the Christian community, we can find substantial foundations that unfortunately have been overlooked. She compares it to the concept of archaeology. You ever hear? I'm sure you have. You know, you read about archaeology, and they start because they're looking for this, and what do they discover after a while? Holy moly, underneath this, there's that. And that is even older than this. That's what she thinks about our traditions. We will never ordain women. Jesus called 12 men. Maybe you dig down there a little bit underneath that and you discover maybe Jesus really was interested in what Mary thought. So that coming up against the themes of the church for her are important. Oh, number four. She talks about non-Christian resources. And what she's referring to there are things like Buddhism, Hinduism, etc. I got interested in Buddhism several years ago when one of our dear friends, Greg Rusiniak, was dying of cancer. And Greg and I, because of geography, but also because of other dimensions, we did a lot of our most significant sharing on email. And one of the things I discovered was that while Greg was losing the battle, he had already won the war. And Buddhism had helped him do that. And so I got interested in Buddhism, and I began to read a little bit about it. And then I actually offered and teach a course in Buddhism at the college. I'll tell you a little funny story about that. That all was going on about the time I was retiring from the active ministry. And the college had run a little story about about me, and they had run about that I was retired from the church, and that I was doing this new class. Brother Sebastian, he's a lovely man. He's a lovely guy. But he reminds me of the advertisement that's out there currently for the Ford Ranger truck. Have you seen it? Apparently you can take a Ford Ranger truck and you can go over rocks, you can climb up ice, you can go through the depths of the woods. And the last little bit of phraseology goes like this. If you're just interested in going to the supermarket, buy any truck. But if you're interested in really experiencing life, buy a Ranger. Sebastian is like going to the supermarket. Boring as hell. Anyway, we're walking down the hall one day and he said to me, John, why are you leaving the church? What do you mean? Well, he said, I read in the paper, you're retiring. And then I read you're teaching a course in Buddhism. He got very serious. Are you a Buddhist? I almost said yes, but I thought that would be he wouldn't get that. Buddhism helps me to be a better Christian. It teaches me, for example, guess what? All this? It's an illusion. We actually think this is real. Not so much. Rosemary Ruther says, we just might benefit from reading some of these non-Christian sources. And finally, she says, we also ought to be reading what she calls postmodern trends. What it means to live in the 21st century and how that is very different from living certainly in the 19th or 18th century, but even the 20th century. And we need to be conversant with all of that. For her, those sources are terribly important. And coming off all that, she reaches a couple of conclusions, and then maybe we can have some discussion. She's a strong advocate of pluralism, obviously. And for her, pluralism is best defined this way. The paradigm of Christ is essential for those of us who are Christians. But what we have to understand is that is not the only paradigm in town. And that we need to become more aware that even as the paradigm of Jesus is the core of who we are, so the paradigm of Buddha is essential for who Buddhists are, etc., etc., etc. Two, she says that we really need to get over the question of whether or not we're positive or negative. And we have to begin to think about whether or not we're loving. And of course, for her, loving is not that silly love ya, warm fuzzy kind of crap. It is what Joseph Fletcher defined almost 50 years ago now. When he says, love is tough. It's not easy because it often requires us to be for someone that we choose to be against. It's not whether we're positive or negative, she says. It's are we loving? Number three, she also says that faith is all about understanding the concepts of mutuality. Nobody should be dominated by anyone else. But rather we should understand the mutuality of the human enterprise. And that mutuality is built upon respect, openness, and affection. Oh, and she's also interested in the environment. She believes that we are killing our planet. And that that is an expression of our personal sin that has been institutionalized. In her book, My Quest for Salvation and Hope, she says, I'm not a tree hugger, but I do think we have trespassed against the intention of the creation. It is good. it is good. And lastly, she believes in ecumenism. She thinks it's time for Catholics and Protestants, as well as Judaism, to come together in mutuality and to share together a common gift. That common gift is the promise of God in the Exodus, certainly in Jesus, certainly in the concept of the Word made flesh, certainly in the concept of the body of Christ. She said, it's time that we begin to realize that the gift we have to give is the gift of freedom for everyone. And I think I'm going to quit there, as I'm probably in over my head already. Maybe you have some questions or comments or ideas you'd like to share, not only about this, but anything else that maybe is running around out there. Please.
There are stories about Michael here. And what popped in my mind was the story and his saying, I feel accepted here. Isn't that the definition of a church, or should be, that whoever you are, whatever your background, I feel accepted?
Absolutely.
And whether you have a building or not doesn't make too much difference.
Mm-hmm.
Great story.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel accepted. And do you ever wonder how that's going? We attend Baldwin Church, where we were privileged to serve for 10 years. And after I retired, we took a hiatus to, you know, get out of the way, that kind of thing. But we've gone back because it really is our home. I look around there on Sunday morning, and I see these young couples with babies. You know what I say? Nobody talks to them. And the kid cries out, yeah! When the kid cries out, what you have to understand is what my teacher taught about that. He said, when a kid cries out in church, you know what you just heard? The future. Think about it. It's the future. So I wonder about how well we're doing as an institution. And that doesn't mean I don't think we're doing some good, because we are. I mean, you don't want to end up being a cynical person, but I think we could do better, yeah. And you're right, it doesn't matter a building, it doesn't matter. It matters whenever a kid like Michael, this is one of the few places I feel accepted. Yeah, please.
You talked early on about Michael. He said this was the only place he felt accepted. That was astonishing. I wondered how other people of different color, different faith, are saying that same thing.
Tons. You know, certainly color is only one expression of that. But come with me to our cafeteria. And consistently, I watched last fall a young kid sit by himself. You know why? It's pretty simple. He's on that autistic syndrome spectrum. He's kind of this way. And so... One day I went over and I said, hi, my name's Jack, what's yours? My name's Blaze! And then Blaze began to come on Tuesday afternoons. And it was so funny. Because for like 2 months, he never sat down. He'd come in and he was, you know. And finally, after 2 months, one of the other students was talking about having difficulty in their major, which was environmental science. Blaze stops, sits down, takes off his jacket, because that's his major. That's his thing. And remember Mitch, I talked about, the accountant guy? Mitch is a great fella. You'd love Mitch. He's just so real. after the meeting was over, and blazed us this way. Constant talk. Mitch said to me, "You know, Doc," he said, "we spent 2 months trying to make Blaze feel at home so he could talk. How are you going to shut him up?" So I think, you know, there's all, another problem we haven't really addressed this one, and that is with our female students. There's some work to be done there, because they are still perceived as girls. And if there's a sexual encounter that they reject, oftentimes what you hear is, "Well, they ask for it." "Oh, I don't think so." You're right on. And I think that is what is so neat about Rosemary Ruther's thought. Yes, it is motivated by and very strongly directed toward the questions of feminism in the life of the church. No doubt about that. But I think some of the things I talked about this morning can be applied in a variety of settings. Please. Yep, that's right.
And visit the Buddhist traditions in Korea, or the grandparents will come to this country, and they feel awkward about bringing the Buddhist grandparents to the Christian church, and so they don't. They would never bring a Buddhist to a Christian church. But the children growing up see the light of Christianity in Buddhism, and they then realize that Buddhism is good, but it's better to have one candle, a Christ candle, than it is to have 100 candles burning for all these old, yep, ancient people who have died. But that's just one example. They do feel that Christianity has great value.
Absolutely. They see it that way because that's their experience in this culture.
Right.
Had they stayed in their own Buddha culture, they would feel the same way about that tradition as well. I mean, we have a number of Muslim kids. Mm-hmm. And one young woman in particular that we got to know pretty well. And she's a very devout kid. And her belief in Allah, God, mirrors anything I've ever seen in a Christian belief of God the Father. I mean, I think that every tradition has both its weakness and its great overwhelming strength, and either of those polarities is to some degree determined by how the practitioner relates to those ideas. And when Christians begin to think that we've got the answer, then we don't. We've become, I think, the problem. Did I see a hand back there?
Yeah, Jack, you alluded to the difference in the difference between Old Testament and New Testament in terms of male orientation. But you do see it in the New Testament too. We talk about the feeding of the 5,000, right? It's men plus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking about it, have been women that Jesus considered disciples. Jesus were considered disciples, but they didn't make the cut in the writing because...
That's well said. They didn't make the cut. That's true. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, how do you wrestle with that?
How do I wrestle with it? Yeah. I don't see a whole lot of difference between the two of them, frankly. I mean, of course, the obvious is the reality of Christ versus the promise of Christ in the Old Testament. I think both testaments hold both the potential and the burdens that we've talked about this morning. And it's how well it, it's I don't mean this, I really don't mean this to be snobby. I really don't. Certainly not intellectually snobby. But I think it has to do with the fact that we're ignorant. I once had a friend, boy, he was a teacher, really. And he talked about, Christians are always going to Bible study. And he said, more often than not, Bible study is nothing more than shared ignorance. There's some truth to that. You get it out of that, and I have an aversion to this, so you'll have to excuse that. You'll have to excuse the overstatement here. I have an aversion to canned stuff. Where you get out, you get the manual and you get the video and you all sit there and look at it. I think that's dangerous. I think when you talk about Bible study, you better talk about people knowing what words mean and what history is about and how it is that these testaments, these books got shaped and molded. What was the intention of the Gospel of Matthew, written by a Pharisaical Jew, as over and against the Gospel of Luke that was written by probably a physician? Or then again, how about Mark, which was just somebody that said, we better write this down before we forget. And then you have John, huh? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word, So I think that it has, I don't see a lot of difference between the testaments in terms of what they drive us to think about and what they support. You can find anything. Who was it? I think it was Mark Twain once said, in the Bible you can find support for just about anything. And there's truth to that. Yeah.
I have a comment about Rosemary. One thing I get is that she was joyful. Like when you meet little children, they're happy.
Mm-hmm.
If in our churches, if we are exclusive, we tend to be protective,
yep,
satisfied, comfortable.
Very stone-like.
Yeah, but not really joyful like her, who was freed from our limits.
Yeah.
That came out of what you presented.
Well, here's her pedigree. Her PhD is from the Claremont School of Theology in California. She's been on the faculty at Harvard, Notre Dame. She retired from being a distinguished professor of George Harkness, the great spiritual writer, at Garrett Theological Seminary, one of our more conservative Protestant theological schools. And I think when you realize she's been so comfortable in the world, why not be joyful? I think there's a, it's not my idea. It comes from a guy by the name of Glaser. He's a psychologist who writes out of a theological perspective. And he says, the more burdens of rightness that you have to carry in life, the more unhappy you are. When you got to be right, you're in deep trouble. Now that doesn't mean you go around being wrong. No. Matter of semantics, please.
Yeah, I think in the Protestant church we view her as sort of a hero, I think. But I'm wondering about the Catholic church.
Well, it depends who you talk with.
Okay, well then.
One of the things we're experiencing at St. Vincent's is this. The monks my age, my vintage, super guys, open, liberal, I think of Renee Kohler, who one day Barbara and I were up on the campus in June. School was out, and I had go up there to do something. And all of a sudden, Barbara said, what in the world was that? It was this booming voice that yelled, Opperly, what the hell are you doing up here today? That's Renee Kohler. We took our grandkids up there one day, and he was talking with them, and he'd ask a question, and both of the boys would answer, and the granddaughter just kind of stood there, and finally he'd ask a question, and he said to the boys, shut up! I want to hear her! That's the kind of guy he is. Really, then there's Elliot Maloney. No habit, nothing. They're just good, solid Christian guys. Interestingly enough, the younger monks, we had one of our younger monks who in Mass spoke these words, if you marry a Protestant, you will have a lifetime of warfare. Some of the Catholic kids came to me and they said, what the hell is he talking about? So I went to him. I said, what kind of a statement did you make there? What was your point? Oh, he said they misunderstood. Oh, no, they didn't. They didn't understand. They got it pretty clearly. Now those people, some of them are interested. They've actually formed a group that is predicated upon the notion that the current Pope Francis is a heretic. And they want him gone. They call him Grandpap. It's a term of derision because he's not out there, you know, banging away and stuff. So depends who you talk to about Rosemary. Oh, yes, Ted, please.
Human impulse to establish a social order, you know, men above women, wealth above poverty,
right,
whatever, straight above gay. And if what you just said, I wonder, does that argue that we're tending towards a steeper social order over time? And I'm wondering what you think about how do you overcome that basic impulse that we all have to figure out who's up and who's down?
Your first point, I think it deserves very careful attention. I think you're right. I think the gaps are getting way too wide. And there's too much anger and hostility and violence associated with that. How do you address that? Well, this has come off pretty simplistic. But 3 years ago, the president of the college asked me to chair a task force to investigate and look at the inclusive nature of our campus. And based upon what we learned and what we began to see, we reached a couple of conclusions. One, gay students were afraid. Two, our female students felt targeted. Three, our black students felt totally disconnected. All three of those are pretty major deals. So I, along with some other people, we started this What's on Your Mind group. Hey, it's never going to win a Nobel Peace Prize. It's 25 or 30 kids sitting in a college basement in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. But Mitch has been changed. Russell has been changed. And we're now losing our president, Norman Hipps. He's retiring. And he stopped by my classroom this week and he said to me, have you seen the new job description for the new president? Well, the answer to that question was I did. You know what's in there? We need a president who is going to be sensitive to the needs of our minority students, which are students of the LGBTQ community, our female students, and our African-American students. I feel pretty good about that. And boy, that's going to, you know, there are people up there who, if you ask them, what do you know about Opperly? It's going to be, he's problem. But I always say to them, look, what you understand is, I'm a token Protestant up here. I'm a token Protestant. And what that means is, I'm responsible for all those federal dollars that come in because they think we're an ecumenical institution. They point to me and say, oh, look there, and then they point to Edelston, the rabbi. So my point is this, Ted. I certainly would never minimize the importance of what we might call historically credible movements. Certainly, who would ever want to say the civil rights movement should have not happened? Who would ever say the NOW movement should never have happened? Of course not. But I really do think that her concerns that relate to the nature of sin being both personal and institutional suggest that perhaps there is a way to address the personal stuff that might just begin to influence the institutional stuff. So my bag is, I'm with George Buttrick. Keep banging on the door. It's slow, hard, dirty work. But I think it pays off, you know, because now that woman that came to my class. She's going home feeling that her kid's okay. And more critically than that even, that kid thinks he's okay. He's going to make it. So that's my response. But I have to admit, yeah, I'm concerned about where we are. And I'm sorry, but I think it has to do with leadership and not only political, but social, theological, etc. I mean, the differences between believers and non-believers is going crazy. I'm sorry, please.
I worked as a secretary in a high school where we had all kinds of kids, you know, religious, different religions, races, beliefs, whatever. So anyway, and I worked in the guidance office, so I got to know a lot of these kids very well. But recently, the church, the one church in Peters is the one who invites the kids to baccalaureate. And they bill it as a Christian baccalaureate. That just rubs me wrong.
Yeah.
Because what are we saying? Only Christians can come?
Pretty much.
Yeah. And I would love to write a letter to this church and say, is this what we need?
Well, we face this at the college, you know, because it doesn't matter whether you're starting the semester or having Honors Day. We have Mass. And at the bottom of the little program, all confirmed Catholics are welcome. And if you're not a member of the church, you can come forward and fold your arms and we'll give you a blessing. No, thank you. So that's a problem that has to do with institutions trying to maintain some kind of ridiculous control. And I'm with you. I think we need to address the fact that there are ways to hold on to the specifics of our traditions without taking away other people's. You know,
well, it seems to me that they think if we invite the other people, they'll be talking to our Christian children, and our Christian children might change their mind. Well, no.
No.
Maybe they'll change their mind and become Christian.
Right.
But when you say a Christian baccalaureate, it just says
stay away.
Everything else.
It's a closed invitation. By invitation only. Yeah. Do it. My family laughs at me, but I do that all the time.
You what?
I do that all the time. I'm a big letter writer. I just think it, and not only about negative things, but when somebody does something good, boom, I'm sorry. I have a good experience at my automobile garage. I write a letter to the service director and say, you know, John Smith did a wonderful job taking care of my car. You didn't know that. Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a real delight and joy.